I'm Lauren Gunderson, and this is 101 Stage Adaptations.
Welcome to 101 Stage Adaptations. I'm your host, Melissa Schmitz. I'm a theater artist and arts administrator, and I wrote my first stage adaptation when I was 22. Now I'm interviewing playwrights about their own adaptations, their creative process, and how they make it all work. Well, hello! If you are here for the first time, welcome. If you have been listening for a while and want more, I am starting a 101 Stage Adaptations newsletter, and I would love for you to join. Click the link in the show notes below, and you'll get a monthly newsletter from me. Y'all, she is here. I'm wearing bright pink today in honor of my guest. She is here. She is here. I've been telling everybody for weeks that I get to do this interview. I'm so excited. Lauren Gunderson is one of the most produced playwrights in America since 2015, topping the list thrice, and she made the list again. It just came out the other day. She is a two-time winner of the Steinberg ATCA New Play Award for I and You and The Book of Will, the winner of the Lanford Wilson Award, the Jeff Award for New Plays, and the Otis Guernsey New Voices Award, and a finalist for the Susan Smith Blackburn Prize, the Arthur L. Weisberger Award, and the John Gassner Award for Playwriting. Revolutionary Women, her new anthology of five plays, is published by Bloomsbury, along with I and You, The Catastrophist, and Anthropology, which recently premiered at Hampstead Theatre. She co-authored the popular Miss Bennett trilogy with Margot Malcon. The Half-Life of Marie Curie was published by Audible Theatre, premiered off-Broadway, and can be heard at audible.com. She just finished her first novel, The Fervor Witch, and will soon premiere several new musicals, including Sinister, with Jiraiya Kwame, I and You, a musical, with Ari Afsar, and Built for This, with Kira Stone, as well as other musicals with the incredible Dave Stewart. She lives in San Francisco with her wonderful family and condescending cat. Please welcome to the show, Lauren Gunderson. Hello!
Hey! What a dream to be here. You're the best. Thanks for wearing pink. I feel very at home.
Oh, I love it. Oh my gosh. So I'm so excited to talk to you again. You and I first chatted on Zoom a couple of months ago via Play Club. And I want to say thank you for introducing me to Play Club. Like, you posted about this new like program where people can read plays and then meet playwrights. And I was like, that's an immediate yes from me.
It's such an awesome program. Anyone watching should join. It's really, really cool. It's, like everyone from Lynn Nottage, and I did one. I mean, it's really neat. But it has the wonderful effect of also meeting fellow play lovers and readers. Yes. And directors and folks like you. So it's a dream.
It's so fun. And I interviewed the founders, Amy Wheeler and Paul Cruz. And so anybody listening can go check out episode 25 for that conversation. But let's get started, Lauren. I have to know, and I ask this of every guest, what is your first theater memory?
You know, I came to this as an actor or performer or a wannabe actor, and I found it quite early. I remember in kindergarten doing an after school Spanish class, and the culmination of the class was a play that we did, Goldilocks and Three Bears in Spanish, and I was hysterically baby bear. And my mom made my little costume with the little round belly and the ears. And I had just the most wonderful time. I have very few memories of it, except for just running lines in the class and holding my little paper and just feeling really great. And then of course we did our performance for a room full of very nervous parents, many of whom did not speak Spanish. So it was all kind of lost on them. But it is now a family lore in the Gunderson family where I dropped my script about halfway through, and the little page just went flew through the air, and of course fell all the way off the stage, and every parent with their holding their enormous camcorders just gasped like, oh no, we're gonna have a meltdown, this poor kid. And my mom says, and my dad loves to tell this part of the story, where I just kind of took a deep breath. Like you could tell I was really tense, took a deep breath, and then did the entire thing by memory, which I didn't tell anyone, nor did I think I knew that I had it by had it memorized. And so I finished the whole play without looking at a script and was very dramatic and, you know, in my delivery. So it kind of, they always point to that as like, that was her first moment where we knew, oh no, she is a theater person.
So. Oh my gosh. That is so fun. Oh, and okay. So from that, how did you decide to make a career in theater? At what point did you decide to make a career in theater? And what did that path look like for you?
You know, it was just this brazen sense of like, this is the thing. This is the thing that I feel, that I think about all the time, that I have endless questions about, that I don't get tired of exploring. And it pivoted from, you know, Baby Bear to, you know, assuming that I would be a performer. I wanted to be an actor. And of course, when you're not from a theater town, I grew up outside of Atlanta in a small town called Decatur, Georgia. And, you know, Atlanta is now quite a substantial theater town, but it was smaller back then. And it's not New York, it's not Chicago or London. Right. And so the access I had was that, you know, watching the Oscars and think, okay, actors, that's what I want to do. The actors who say the thing and, you know, going to see plays and seeing, well, who do you see? You see actors. But then when I kind of, it just occurred to me, well, who is telling them what to say? They're not doing that, right? And it just this tidal kind of sense of keep coming back to theater, come back to theater, and realizing all the different ways to be a part of the telling of the story. And then, of course, finding the one that I really wanted to, which was connected to seeing a lot of plays and saying, why are there so few women on stage? And why are, and connecting it to the, oh, who is directing this? Who is writing it? What does a director and a writer actually do? And of course, it doesn't take too long to say like, oh, there's not many women doing those jobs either. So no wonder we have a one-sidedness, a bias in the history of theater. And of course, looking for those exceptions, finding Lynn Nottage and Paula Vogel and Sarah Rule and Lorraine Hansberry and Carol Churchill and seeing, okay, we are here and we have been. And so I found, you know, finding the sisterhood of those great creatives helped me understand how to be a part of it.
That's so great. So we're here today to talk about the Time Traveler's Wife musical. How did you get hired to write the book for that?
You know, I got advice going into this meeting from a friend of mine, Lucy Alabar, because I was like, I want to do this so much. This is my favorite book. It is perfect for me. It is the music I can feel in my bones. I know how to tell this story and I know how to do it right. And I was so, you know, when you want something so much, it actually makes the getting of it sometimes harder.
Yes.
And so Lucy gave me the advice, said, you know what, just go in there and don't talk around it. Talk to it. Say, I am the perfect person for this. I am, you know, just say the thing you know to be true. And it's going to sound too much and you're going to sound too brazen and you're going to sound too pushy. But frankly, that's what the men do. So you should show up and say, here's why I'm perfect for this. There's no one better for this than me. And of course, the Southerner in me was like, oh, I could never, I could never. But I did. I went in there. And it also helped that I'd written the first act already, just as a kind of here's the outline. Here's how I would break up the story to get to the act, you know, to kind of say, I basically already wrote it. So give me the job already. and you know, but it comes with having a vision and having confidence and being able to describe what I'm like to work with as a writer. And that all meant that I was able to say I'm collaborative. I want it to be visual and emotional. I want it to be singable. And I am the kind of writer that if something doesn't work, we cut it. I'm not going to keep it just because I wrote it. Whoever the best idea in the room wins. And I think that's all that the producer, Colin Ingram, needed to hear. But he did take a chance on me. I hadn't written musicals at that point, except for young adult and theater for young audiences musicals. They were with the Kennedy Center, which is pretty prestigious. But, you know, I didn't have anything on Broadway. I didn't have anything to point to except for a strong vision, confidence, and a sense of I know how to do this. So here we are.
Oh, that's awesome. So your agent, like, pitched you for this meeting, or how did you find out about this meeting, or who was looking for a book writer?
The producer, as they often do, if they have a project, they go to the agencies and say, I'm looking for someone like this. Who would you want to meet? So I was on the list of a few of the folks that they suggested, and met with him in New York when I was working on another show. I can't remember what it was at this point. So we sat down and I knew what, you know, kind of don't throw away your shot. So I went in strong.
And so this is literally your favorite novel, Time Traveler's Wife.
You know, it's funny. I am obsessed with novels now and have had, you know, phases in my life where I'm a big reader. But then sometimes, you know, when you work in a creative job and your vocation and your passion is telling stories, I don't, when I'm done with that for the day, don't often turn to other stories. So mm-hmm. I would read mostly biographies and history and science texts and things like that, and kind of didn't think that novels had as much of a place. But this one always just struck me, and how, you know, The Time Traveler's Wife was hit me at the right time and was so sweeping and so strange and so complex. And it just blew my mind. And I particularly was so moved by the last chapter, which readers will know that's the one. And we have to say to our reading, our book nerd audience, which they always ask, are you doing it like the movie did it? Or are you ending it like the book ends it? And I was like, girl, the book always. But it felt like a story for me. And as I've, over the last 10 years, I've done more and more and more and more musicals that they do take a very long time to make. And so I would forgive someone for not assuming that I write a lot of musicals, because there haven't been as many that have come out. Mm-hmm. But this one just felt like it had to sing to me. And
Yeah. And in the credits, it lists both the novel and the film, based on the novel and the film. Who negotiated the rights for both of those? And did you have conversations with the author and the screenwriter as you were working on this project?
No, we didn't look at the screenplay at all. That was not at all what I used. Because the movie is beautiful in a lot of ways, but it did not feel like the story that I wanted to tell.
Sure.
So that is just because Warner Brothers owns the rights to the book and all screen adaptations. So that was more of a contractual thing. You kind of have to say it's based on the movie when it is not.
Got it.
And I was incredibly honored to have met Audrey, the author, when I was in Chicago last working on another musical. And it was just a very casual thing. And it's really important, because the book is the book and nothing will ever be the book except for that. And so I wanted to make sure that she knew that this iteration comes from a devotion to her story, mm-hmm. but it needs different things to be in this medium. And so it was a very interesting process. She did not advise as we were going through. And that is because of something I really respect about her, which she doesn't really want to. She's like, I don't want to see the movie. I don't want to see the adaptations. Those are characters that belong to me and my brain in such a specific way that any version of the characters where they're singing songs is not the characters I wrote, which I totally respect that.
Sure.
It's like, that is an amazing to have that distance and protect that distance from something that is, of course, a worldwide phenomenon. And so she is the origin of all of that. But I think that's what's wonderful about adaptation is how they are different things as well as the same, but different, but the same, but different, but the same.
And what makes your adaptation different from the original novel? And what was your biggest challenge in adapting it for the stage?
Well, most of it is going back to the title and saying, this is the Time Traveler's Wife. So we're following her. And the Time Traveler is incredibly compelling and surprising and exciting because of his time travel. Yeah. But it says the novel is called The Time Traveler's Wife, so it's about her. And in the theater, we need one main character. And so unlike the movie and the TV show and other adaptations that largely follow him, we're following her. And so it is the story of her growth and journey and the strange, you know, folding inwards mystery of their life and love. And it allows, I think, the story to be kind of surprisingly universal, which it seems the fantastical nature of it shouldn't feel like that. But it really is a big metaphor for mortality, for things we cannot control that will define our lives. And that is his time travel and the danger as well as the delight of that. Mm-hmm. And in that way, we're really talking about something everyone's going to come up with. Like, what do you do when you know you don't have too much time? What do you do when your the love of your life is in a profession or has a condition that is life-threatening.
Yeah.
And you know, you're going to lose them. But isn't that all love? And isn't that, isn't that why we give our hearts to people knowing that it will hurt at some point?
Right.
And so do you not do that at all, or do you brave it together? And so it allowed us to write something that dips into the grandiose as well as the intimate, and the powerful beauty of knowing that things will get hard, but a life lived with love is worth living. And so it's been a dream. And of course, music helps tell those stories better than anything, you know. The songs about bravery and loss and first love and the question of the heart is the stuff of all great music. So it feels very natural to pair those for this particular story.
I love that. So for people who are less familiar with the craft of musicals, can you describe what a book writer does and what you are contributing to this project?
Yeah. I mean, the book writer does basically everything. it seems like I write the lines between the songs, but in truth, I structure the whole story. When we meet the characters, what are they up against? How the scenes break down? Where the songs come? What is a song? What isn't a song? So it is very easy to assume that the book writer just, you know, writes the script part. But part of the script, anyone who's knows about playwriting, is no script is just the dialogue. It's the world. It's the depth of the characters. It is the backstory that drives them forward. It is the moments of crisis that are put in just the right place so that we can get to an intermission moment of clarity and surprise and a kind of climactic character defining crisis at the end. And that just doesn't happen because you write, hi and little lines. You're world building and character building at every moment. So how it generally worked for this is figuring out what are parts of the novel to include in what order that might mimic the actual novel, but some were in a different order to highlight different things. Again, in a musical or a play, you only have 2 hours, and a novel, of course, you can sit with for weeks. So making sure that things are efficient, clear, and then breaking the story open and saying, okay, I can now set up the song. So we want to have the script and the book earn the moments of song. And that means I need to build the ramp up and the ramp out. And if there's any dialogue necessary in the middle. But that really comes from working closely with the music team and saying, it's not just, hey, here's a song about love. Why don't you write that? And then we'll start the story when that's over. No, the songs need to be a part of the story. They need to be a part of the decision-making of the characters, the risk-taking, and something needs to change by in the middle of the song. Usually it's in the bridge where a decision is made, a revelation is contended with, a path is set because the character is singing about love. And is it right? And should I do this? Should I trust this person? And then in the bridge, they say, yes, I'm going to trust this person. One more verse or one more chorus, and then we're out. So knowing song structure, knowing scene structure, knowing that everything has to push the story forward, that's when I can be very clear with the songwriting team and saying, here's a song. It's in this person's voice. This is what they're thinking about and going through and what they need. Here's the moment they have to decide. They need to decide this within the song. And if you can reference these three symbols, that'd be great because I'm going to use them in about two scenes. Thank you so much. So in that way, it really is a matter of clarity so that the songwriters can do their best work. And the song, the play needs the song, not just kind of tolerates the song. So that's part of it.
Right. And let's tell the people who your songwriting team is.
Yes. The incredible privilege of working with Joss Stone, who literally the soundtrack of all the breakups in my 20s were Joss Stone singing her incredible, beautiful soul sound. It's empowering. Mm. It's feminist, but it's also, heartbreaking and beautiful and funny. And her songs just have, given me such energy and camaraderie. Felt like, she was writing for me. So that's an amazing thing. She was brought on by the other part of the music team, Dave Stewart of the Eurythmics, which is pretty rad. He's amazing. What an intelligent, collaborative guy, always in sunglasses, covered in tattoos, and now has his own vodka line, which is perfection. He is the greatest. And just like such a consummate musician, can just take the guitar and in 3 seconds have a hook. He's amazing. So that team is really wonderful. And it felt like the right team for this particular show. Again, having Dave's wisdom, an incredible musicianship, and just, man, can that man write a hook. And then having Joss kind of represent this more femininity, this artistic kind of flair that she has always had. And for this particular story, it felt like we needed both. And then there were additional lyrics by one of my favorite colleagues, Kate Kerrigan, who I think almost nobody knows musical theater better than her from a lyric perspective, and such a great storyteller with a single word. So she was brought in about halfway through to kind of, take what Joss and Dave were doing so beautifully and, you know, help align it in some of those more, you know, technical scenes, and technical meaning we need this montage to do this, this, and this, and it has to fit with the choreo that does this, this, and this. And, you know, that takes somebody who's really, really, really experienced with musical theater. So I trust Kate implicitly, and she was amazing to come in and help. But it's just so cool to be able to be in the room with that level of musical talent. It's just wild. And, you know, the other part that is interesting to know for those who don't spend a lot of time making musicals or, you know the ins and outs is, so the music comes in and sometimes it is a voice memo from Dave and Joss just singing in a studio, and it's just him on the guitar and her singing. and that is the song. And then it goes to our amazing, I mean, stunning musical director and composer, Nick Finlow, who is, you know, West End royalty, has done everything, and the absolute nicest guy, who it's his job to take those songs, get, among other things, get it on the page so that we can see it, and then start playing with, well, what is the orchestration? How do we add, what's the groove behind this? What are the harmonies? Especially if it's not a solo, right? Okay, now it's a duet, it's a trio, it's a group number. Well, somebody's got to write the music parts for all of that. And Nick is the one who holds all of that in his mind and generates these kind of iconic songs that he's come up with based on their melody and lyric and the kind of the sound that Dave created for it. So,
oh, that's so cool. So when Lauren Gunderson and Joss Stone and Dave Stewart are working on an artistic project together and something's not quite clicking, or you have a disagreement about how something should go, who wins? Who decides how it's going to be resolved?
You know, it doesn't ever feel like a win and a lose, you know? It feels like, again, what fits, what really sinks into the story. So there was a couple songs that we had in earlier versions that were lovely in their own right, but including the very first song of the show when we did an out-of-town production before we brought it to the West End, and the first number was a very different number. It was softer. It was a longer number that was kind of sweeter and more ephemeral. And it was a lovely song, but it just, all of us kind of realized, like, I don't think that's this, it wasn't right. So we ended up going back to a different, something way more crisp and sudden. And, you know, it turned a 6-minute song into a minute and a half. And, you know, but that's just because all of us kind of said, well, okay, well, let's assume that this is not there. What would we write there if we didn't already have a song here? And sometimes that's just worthy of the question. But it's also, you know, important for everyone to kind of be able to fight for their darlings. And there's some stuff that I was like, oh, I think we can cut it. And somebody's like, I really like it. Let's do it one or two more times. And that's a great thing. You want people to fight for something that means something to them. And I do that too. You know, and then there were some songs that, you know, needed a couple different iterations to get there. One of my favorite numbers that always gets massive applause in the second act is what for a long time was written in the script as Claire's Mad as Hell song, which we didn't have lyrics for, but we knew, okay, he has betrayed her so thoroughly. She needs a big old number and it's going to be feisty. And this is Joss Stone at her absolute best, writing the like, oh no, you do not cross me song. So Joss wrote the hell out of it. And then, you know, Dave bringing, you know, finding the rhythm and the grit, and, you know, but like the chorus wasn't quite, okay, how are we going to do this? And do we reference it specifically or are we really more vague about the betrayal in some ways? Cause you want to be able to have people singing at karaoke for whatever betrayal they're going through and not specifically reference it, but then it has to belong in the show. And so there's a lot of kind of battle over even one word sometimes was to wasn't, or, you know, me to us. And sometimes it changes a whole flavor. So sometimes those are the things where Joss and Dave are so generous and collaborative that they would trust myself and Bill, our director, and Nick to kind of know, okay, we just changed a few things to make it work. And they're like, yeah, good.
So. I love that. Oh my gosh. Well, I had the great fortune of interviewing your teacher, Vincent Murphy, on this podcast. Yay. And we talked about his book, The Craft of Adaptation, which he says an adaptation begins with a central theme of the story. And you touched on this a little bit before, but what are the themes that you are tackling or like honing in on in Time Traveler's Wife? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there is a lot of them in musicals end up as songs. So mm-hmm. The big theme is our opening and final song, which is called Love Wins the Day. And it is could feel like a very naive song. But once you go through the story, you realize it's a defiant song. It is a song that is hopeful, but knows that it's not going to end perfectly and not everyone's going to make it through the show. And that is also life. And so you either say, because we contend with sorrow and loss, you know, love hasn't won, or because we got to love it all. And still, through that sorrow and loss, we still retain that love after, then it is worth doing. And so that's part of it. There's another wonderful song called On and On, which is, you know, starts with a lyric, all I have is this little time on earth. And it is this, a way to say, of course, I mean, mortality isn't just the burden of a time traveler who can't control where he's going. It's all of ours. And so knowing how to say, we will, all we have is this moment. And so let us live it with love and let us live it with honesty and let us live it with the people who bring out our very best and see us for all of who we are. And that's kind of all you can do in an entire life, right? Is that. And so in some ways it's not a very shocking theme. And honestly, most great plays have themes that we've seen in 1,000 different ways. It's just done, told in a different way. So that's where we are here. Yeah.
That's great.
Love wins the day.
Love wins the day. Always.
Oh, such a good song. Oh, epic.
So a major part of the story of the novel, the story is that this woman is spending a lot of time and energy waiting for this man to show up in her life. And I'm wondering, because I'm struggling with this, Lauren, a little bit. I'm wondering, as a feminist, if that bothered you at all.
Oh, that's why I rewrote it.
Okay. All right. Yes. More about
and
that.
The truth is, I want Claire, our main character, she is in love, and we do things that are sometimes very unliberated or unfeminist, and that's actually okay to be devoted to somebody and to wait for them and to help them and to give them your time and energy beyond other things. And if that person is a man and you're a woman, that it doesn't mean that you're a bad feminist to be in love with man. And so it started with that, of going, okay, she can have her epic love story. She can love him so much. And also, what I did in this adaptation is make it very clear that she is struggling with the waiting herself, that she's going, I do want to wait for him and I do not want to wait for him. And I do not want this man controlling my life. And I also love him so much and care so much that I will do things that I wouldn't do for anyone else for him. And that's actually fantastic. That's what love is. Right. You know, Lizzie and Darcy do the same thing, right? Yes. She's like, I don't want to be in a relationship with a guy who makes me feel like that. And yet I really do want to be in a relationship with you. And the tension of being the pride and the prejudice of it. That's why it's so good, right? They're going to be together. We want them to get married. And also we want her to be like, you jerk. You don't get to talk to me about my family like that. Damn it. And then he gets to say, I am so sorry. I did it wrong, which our character of Henry does in this show too. So one of the other things is making it very clear that, their dynamic is driven by her, that she is saying, you see me as an artist. The character is an artist in the book. And we made that very central to her self-identity. Mm-hmm. She sees herself as a maker, a creator, a visionary, an artistic person, not the love of his life. So aligning those things. So when he compliments her, he asks about her art. She says to him in the very first scene of the play, you know, you were the friend I needed. You were the first person to call me an artist, and it meant the world to me. You always understood me and let me talk about the things that mattered to me. Which is, I think we lean on that more than the novel does, certainly more than the movie or anyone does. So giving Claire, frankly, the feminist, it's very easy feminism in some ways, to give her own thing, give her agency, give her a world of her own. And so much of our adaptation focuses on what she needs to do her art and how he helps and aligns that with his world. He also, you know, honestly, my favorite feminist piece of art ever is Dirty Dancing, because I have an entire thesis. If I were to go back to grad school, I would write a PhD on the feminist tract that is Dirty Dancing, because it allows for a full love story and a sexual love story, but done in a way where the guy is never calls her beautiful, never says, like, I want you to be my wife. Like, he doesn't do any of those romance tropes. He says she's brilliant. He says she's brave. He lets her come up with the plan. I mean, she comes up with all of the plans. She you know, kisses him first. And that's a lot of what I was leaning on for this adaptation, too, is making sure Claire was in charge. And, you know, so, yeah, it's great. Her first song, her first I Want song, the second song of the show is called Masterpiece, which is about her art and him being a part of that art. You know, she kind of uses the word masterpiece to describe her own life and her artistic goals, but also her life with him. Like, that's a masterpiece too. If we do it right, we can have both coincide. So, but I made that very clear to our producer when I first started, of like, this is going to be, and you're going to thank me later. I was like, Colin, you're going to thank me later. This is going to be the one that my feminist friends can go and see and not cringe and be like, oh, I wish she didn't just sit at home and wait for him. He's like, oh no, she does it in this one. No. She's right. Got an entire world of her own. So
right. Oh, I love that you made her life as an artist a central point, because I feel like I kind of missed that in the book. I saw an interview with the actors where they're making paper birds and they're like, Claire makes all these birds show up in the musical. I'm like, what is that? Where do these come in your adaptation?
Well, that was a collaboration with the set designer and the costume designer, and finding a visual symbol for Claire's art, but also obviously has references to Henry's condition. So the sense of flight, which that would be specific to this production. It's not really written in the script, but it became such a lovely way for Claire's art to be a metaphor for Henry and you know, Henry to influence Claire's art. So it felt very circular and lovely. But yeah, it's all about art. And I think that is a nice way also to kind of write about what it is to be a theater maker too. I mean, all of us feel a bit of time travelers as well when we stay up all hours, and our working hours are different from most of the world. And we put so much of our heart and soul into something, and often it only lasts for a little while. So there's a lot of resonance that we were drawing on as a creative team to say, I think this means this is kind of like theater. It's kind of like creative art makers as well. So,
yeah. In the novel, the city of Chicago is like another character in the story. And I lived in Chicago for 3 years and I could visualize like every street and landmark that she mentions in the book. As we're like following all these characters on this journey around town. Does Chicago feature prominently in this adaptation, which ironically is premiering in London with British actors?
Yes and no. I mean, we talk about it, but we don't really spend a ton of time. There's one great park scene that feels very Chicago, and the set design includes projections that the savvy Chicagoan would be like, oh, yeah, there we go. I see that. Most of it just focuses on the characters more than the location.
Cool.
But they are American. They have American accents. They do. I was a kind of... But you know, default accent coach, even though they had a wonderful coach for everybody. I always get the, like, how do you say this again?
Yeah. What were some of the harder words for them?
You know, one of the ones that I find British actors get are hard is the word anything. Anything in American is how I just said it, but most British actors will say anything. And so but it's wonderful. Everyone's got great performances, and we have young actors as well in it. And so that's been a joy to see them, you know, flourish in these roles too, and just kind of say, "Ooh, you've got a long career ahead of you, like young ladies. Y'all are awesome."
I love it. So obviously the main feature of this story in any iteration is the magic and mystery of Henry's time travel abilities. And for those not familiar with this story, when Henry time travels, he leaves his clothes behind. And when he appears at his destination, he quickly needs to find clothes. How are the logistics of time travel staged in this? And did you as the writer have to figure this out, or was this something for a director or a designer?
Oh, yeah. Well, we first and foremost, all of this goes to our amazing illusionist, Chris Fisher, who did Harry Potter, among many, many other plays that a lot of people would have seen. He is an absolute magician genius for the stage. So he designed all of the illusions, all the disappearances. And it was, you know, originally I probably had like 25% more disappearances in the script. And Bill and I, the director, had to kind of finally realize like, okay, maybe need to like cut that down a little bit.
Right.
But it's part because we don't want the audience to get used to it. We want it to be a surprise every time. And, you know, one of the ways we do that is we have a pretty insane, like disappear in front of your eyes illusion about halfway through. And that's the one that is the most kind of mind scratching for an audience. Like he literally just disappears in front of you. What? But the earlier ones, you can kind of, we purposefully said, okay, we're going to kind of do it in a way where you go, huh, interesting, but you kind of maybe figure it out. There's one insane illusion in his song Wait For Me, which is I think the most striking one. But so we kind of pace them out of like, okay, this is going to happen. And some of them are just sleights of hand and some of them are sneaky reveals. And, you know, some you can be like, oh, I see. He probably went through the door, or it happens off stage. And our digital designer has these great graphics that, you know, of him poofing away and everything. But that's kind of a digital version. So we want to toss it up so you don't kind of look for it every time. But it's extraordinary. And that's in some ways of the reason to do it, certainly with this level of production, like a West End production, is because you get the budget and the intrigue. Some people are buying tickets. A lot of people are buying tickets to go, how are you going to do that? Like, how do you do it on stage? And we're like, buy a ticket and see. Come on to the circus.
Oh, I love it. I love magic. And I saw a stage production of Macbeth that Teller of Penn and Teller was involved with, and there was all sorts of illusions, and it was very exciting. So I didn't realize that was like a major design aspect of this show was the illusions.
Yeah. Well, and when I started working in the UK, we had, that is a part of the stage team, is there are lots of illusionists that work in, and my plays apparently need a lot of illusionists because I keep having them on the team, which is extraordinary. INU had a wonderful illusionist for the final moment at Hampstead Theater. And that's when I thought like, wait, this is a job? You can be like a stage illusionist? I want to make plays in London all the time. I want illusionists all the time.
Oh, same. Oh my gosh. Great. That's so fun. Lauren, if you could time travel to any period of your life or any period in history, where would you go?
It would probably be a brief trip because it would probably be shocking and unhealthy. But I would say, like early 1600s London. I got to see a play at the Globe.
Yes.
Meet Mr. Shakespeare, hang out a little bit.
Same.
That's what my novel is about, is that delightful fantasy. So I'm like, no, that's still my fantasy. I'm just going to go hang out with Shakespeare and see a play at the Globe.
Amazing. Okay, we're going to talk about that a little bit later. I want to know how your training as a physicist influences your writing and crafting of a story.
I mean, I am a armchair scientist. So I studied it in bits throughout my undergrad, but it's mainly just knowing and loving the sciences as a source of inspiration, as a source of perspective on, again, this little time on Earth. And so that has, since I started writing plays, been a great source of story for me because it feels big and important. It feels like a thing we should be writing about, these moments of human intellectual evolution and, you know, what are the pivotal discoveries? And then, let's write. Who made them? Who are you? What are you thinking? What else is going on in your life? Why this moment, this person? and this discovery then. So it became kind of an endless source of inspiration for plays. And I've written about so many scientists, a lot of physicists and astronomers. There's something just so fundamental about that form, but I owe chemistry a play. I owe biology. Well, The Catastrophist is about biology, but I love it. And at that moment, when I started, I was, you know, ending high school, and I wrote a lot really early, and entering college. And it was just the kind of Copenhagen stoppered Arcadia moment of going, mm-hmm. Oh, science on stage, what a thought. Mm. And so I kind of, you know, bullied my way into that category and have stayed there determinedly for a while. So I love telling the stories of science.
That's so great.
But I do think about it in terms of your question about like, how does it affect, I didn't quite answer the question you asked, but the idea of thinking of creativity and storytelling with an engineering, almost theorist like mm-hmm. lens is something that's very central to me. So, mm-hmm. and it's central not because I'm proving anything, but because it works. I am mm-hmm. able to write a story more surely, more efficiently, and thus finish the dang draft so we can get in the room with actors and find all of the other stuff. You can't do that until you got the dang script written. So part of writing the script, and it's true with Time Travelers as well, is what are the structural things of the story? What's the scaffolding, the architecture that helps us get these characters on a journey where they have to change in manifold ways, but you have to space out those changes. Those big moments have to be at the right place. You can't have them all at the front or all at the back. You have to be able to have a midpoint that is striking and enough to earn the second act and give us enough, you know, momentum to get through the second act. And then what is the point of a story? What are mm-hmm. we driving to? What is the answer at the end of the experiment that is this story, which I do think of stories as thought experiments. But if you literalize that and actually say, okay, the scientific method actually tells you how to write a play. The structure of the scientific method is exactly what a play is trying to do. We have a thesis, mm-hmm. and you know, we're going through trying to prove, does it work? We're going to fail. The character is going to fail. And in the scientific method, you fail a bunch and you learn every time you keep going. Mm-hmm. And then the end result at the end of a story and an experiment is, were we right? did it work? And the answer can be no. But it has to be something that is so defining. The end of a story is a definition. It is a clear concretization of who the character thinks they are and who they actually are. Much like in science, to extend the metaphor, you know, you're going to concretize. Were you able to prove it or not? is this a true thing that we now know? So thinking of it like that helps me kind of swim through the process of writing with confidence and clarity of where to go next, what next scene. So you don't hit that 30-page slump and go, oh, I was writing so well, and then I don't know what to write next. And my answer is always like, yeah, you don't. You mm-hmm. should. You know what's going to help you know what to write next? Know the ending. Trust the structure. Answer these big moments so that you can know where you're writing to, and then the structure will save you. The structure will help and give you to know, well, all right, it's about time for this character to have a surprise crisis they have to deal with that either brings this other character closer or farther away from them. It has to We need to have a big shakeup in this so the character knows how hard this thing is. We need to make it harder for them. We need to have this. Anyway, so it's stuff like mm-hmm. that where you, when you realize the structure of storytelling is there is not a cage, but it is a tool to go mm-hmm. on a journey. It doesn't trap you in telling a story like everyone else. It actually liberates you to say, like, once you get the structure, once you know where you're going, you can write it exactly as you want it. Like, you've got wings. Mm-hmm. You can fly anywhere. But I don't know how to steer. So
that's so great. Does your approach to writing change whether it's a musical or a play or an original piece versus an adaptation?
Ooh. Yeah, but generally no, specifically yes. Generally anything you do has to be a great story. And so that structure is going to work. You have to be able to structure a play, and whether you're inheriting characters and details and plot points, you still have to structure which ones are there. That was certainly the true for Time Traveler's Wife. Like, there's a lot of that book that we didn't have room for, can't you know, work. And there was a lot that we needed to put it exactly the right place so that our characters can go on that more succinct journey than the novel allows them to go on. But that is all structure based. And musical theater has a lot of extra scaffolding because there are expectations, which again, I find liberating, not constraining, which is we're going to need an opening number. What's our opening number that gets all the voices together, kind of a tone setting moment? How do we start this show? Okay, if you're Les Mis, we're in the middle of this kind of terrible prison, you know, situation, but it is also our the starting place for the character that will drive the whole thing.
Right.
And our second song needs to be from our main character's perspective, which answers the question, who's this story about? Why do we care about them? What do they care about? Why are we going on this journey at all? And whose journey are we following? So we need to have a song about them. You know, and so then the idea of what most musicals kind of demand formulaically helps us get know those numbers. So the end of Time Traveler's Wife, or the act break in the middle, is a wedding. It's called Time Traveler's Wife. You'll be shocked they get married, but it's like right in the middle. And part of that is because it's a wedding. It's a party. There's so many people. That number right before the act break is a group number. It's an ensemble piece. And so this is a big moment to have a big a number right before we go to intermission. So it's stuff like that that helps. Original pieces are the hardest because there is nothing telling me what to do next. I have to generate all of it. So it takes a lot of self-interrogation for me to find the answers that other writers have already figured out for me. If I'm adapting something, I'm starting a Little Women adaptation and like, okay, there's a lot of pieces that we're going to need there. My job is to more orient and kind of have a take on it. As opposed to generate, like, who are these characters and what do they want? So all of that, you know, but it again flows into the same kind of riverbed of where are you going? What's the end? How do we, as soon as you know a version of the ending, you can write towards that ending. And as soon as you know the ending, you're going to need to have a contradictory moment halfway through. That's our midpoint. If you have an intermission, that's where it is. So what is the contradiction to that ending that we're going to need to play with in the middle? And then that backs you up to, okay, well, if that's where we're going, how do we start to aim to both earn that midpoint contradiction and the character defining crisis that is the end? So you kind of can reverse engineer it, but it all starts with going, okay, what's the end? what are we, because the end answers, what's the point? What is this? Why are you doing this? what is the thought experiment? What's the thesis? What thought experiment are you trying to prove? What is the thing that you want in a play? And the funny thing about my job and all of the writers out there is you can just make the thing you want. Isn't that delightful? We can literally go, I would like a story about a woman who's a hero, goes through hell, but is resilient and survives in the end. And you can write it. Because if you want it, someone else does. What a dream. Isn't that just the coolest?
Yeah. So. Oh, that's so great. So you may have answered with that my next question, which comes from Monica, who is a super fan of this podcast. And the question is, what is your process for choosing the story within an adaptation and for your science and history plays when you have a historical moment or, you know, a whole novel to figure out? What is your process for honing down the story that is best served in a stage format?
Wow, that is a great question. Thank you, Monica. Hello. You know, I think that theater in particular is the stuff of emotions. And so I am always looking for the love story. And not the, you know, cheesy melodrama version, but when does the heart take over so much that whatever else is going on, that is still the driving force. And this can be a sisterly love, a love of friendship, a camaraderie, an impossible love, or romantic in all the versions of romance that there are. And that to me is the driving force because it is incredibly relatable and incredibly bodily. It's human. And what the greatest tool we have on stage are people, are actors. And so in some ways, as intellectual as some, you know, plays can be, whether they're about science or great themes in politics or on and on, I'm really here for what what turns that the heart of the main character on to full blast. Mm-hmm. And for me, if you don't have that in a play or a musical, I don't know why you wouldn't, because it so belongs there. This is the stuff of theater.
Right.
The stuff of theater is emotion. And like, mm-hmm. I can get in a fight with Brecht about this all day, and I will and have, but there are other forms that are better and more effective at teaching us ideas and statistics, mm-hmm. And that has a home in theater, but I don't think it is a driving force. I think what theater does the best is walk in somebody's shoes, is say, oh my God, I have felt that as well. Mm-hmm. Or what would I do in that scenario where my heart wants this and my family wants that? On and on, you know what I mean? So I think what I'm always looking for in an adaptation is where the love story is. And if there's not one there, I'll put it in. And I tell you, the plays work better. Mm-hmm. So if I'm taking any historical character, I'm just embarking on a new one now. And my first thought of going, wow, she was this amazing surgeon. And, you know, during wartime, you know, blah, 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 all this, you know, interesting stuff about this historical woman. And I was like, right, but who'd she love? Who is on her mind when she is running for her life, or when, you know, she has a moment to herself? Who is it? And, you know, love is so vulnerable and so can be so enlivening. And it's just, I don't know, the human experience is full of a lot of hardship. And then there is a gleaming place where we have evolved into a species that can feel these things. Mm-hmm. And love isn't always easy or good. Which sometimes that's a great driver. Honestly, it's probably more interesting if you shouldn't be with the person. Hi, Romeo and Juliet. Like, that's the whole reason, right?
Yeah.
So there is so much there. And it seems like a denial of one of our greatest assets is you have people in front of you, and they're there to feel, and they are there to go through hell and heaven in front of us. And one of the greatest drivers of the human experience is love. So we have to have to have it in all of.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, it's so good. I'm curious to know the difference as a playwright working in the US versus the UK in terms of like their process over there and the systems they have and the workflow and also like the logistics of like work visas and what other things American artists need when they have projects in the UK.
Yeah, I mean, the producer was graciously helpful with any visas I needed. But I think London is the greatest place to make theater on earth. The talent, the vision of every creative member that I worked with on any show that I've done there has been extraordinary. It is also a place which, as an American, stuns me every time how committed audiences are to the theater. It is so organic for them to want to see plays, to reach out and find theater, to give a play a try. It's so ingrained into their culture, into their young education, that I do think it makes a difference in the kind of audiences you get. And that makes a difference in the kind of work we can support and we can make. So you can take bigger risks there. You know, it's not entirely perfect, of course, but there is also the difference of how expensive it is to put on a Broadway show. It's like a third the amount to do a West End show. So that, again, means you can do more things. The stakes are lower. Personally, I think the critics in London, because there are so many of them and so many functioning papers, means that you get a broader diversity of opinions. So it doesn't have the kind of, the guillotine of the New York Times hanging over you as like it does in New York, which has unfortunately defined and denied a lot of great creativity because it's one person's review that dictates whether this goes on and on. Now that's less true now that honestly the internet being the internet allows for, you know, some breakouts. But in London, I feel like it is, it's a more diverse audience. It's, I love it so much over there. And I have incredible homes in the US, of course, and theater companies and theater leaders that, are my ride or dies. And I adore them and always love developing plays, but it has been a difference. And, you know, just little, not little things, but even the theaters themselves feel more welcoming. I have probably one of my longest relationships with Hampstead Theater over there, which is kind of like a, like a Manhattan Theater Club sort of theater in the UK. They did an insane production of INU that was extraordinary. We just did Anthropology with them. I just love them so much. But what they're a great example of, when you walk in the theater's open from 8 a.m. on because there's a cafe there. You go get a flat white on your way to the tube to work, and you may never see a play there. You may just go because the coffee is really good. But the idea that it is a more central community space, instead of we open the doors at 7 and the show's at 7:30, and as soon as you're done, you got to get out and leave because we're closing the doors.
Right.
You know, no, it's open. You can go have your lunch there. There's a farmer's market 2 times a week that shows up outside the theater, and you can, you know, get local honey. I mean, it really is idyllic. And I name one theater that does that in the U.S.
No.
I mean, I'm sure somebody's going to, in your comments, going to be like, well, here's one. And I'm grateful for them. But I wish every theater had that sense. And it would just take a revolution in our culture to produce theaters that function in that way. But I think that's, again, just such an obvious example of the difference of a theater is a place that is for community. It's open all the time. It is, it is a place where you can go grab some Wi-Fi and have a cup of coffee and a conversation, and come see a play because they're really good too, you know? So I think that's part of what I'm sort of obsessed with, is that sense of openness, as well as a beautiful generative quality.
I love that. How much time did you spend in London working on Time Traveler's Wife?
A bunch. I mean, we've been developing it for almost 6 years. And so would include probably every year. Again, pandemic was in the middle and threw us for a big old loop like everyone did. But I would be over there several times a year for a week or two for workshops. And then, you know, a lot of conversations on Zoom and stuff. But my goal when I go to London is always to leave with another reason to come back to London. So it's been a lot this year as we were developing, and last year when we did the production at a beautiful theater in a town called Chester, which is outside of London. So,
yeah. And where are you right now? What room am I looking in?
This is my office in San Francisco.
Okay, perfect. And when did you get back? Because I feel like you were just saw there. You on Instagram in London. Yes.
I was there. Yes, I've had this will be my fourth trip to London in 3 months. It's coming up. I leave in about a week to go for opening night, which they call press night. So that'll be my final trip of the year, sad face. But I have already schemed ways to come back next year. Yes, I've been there a bunch, but it's all, you know, it's hard being away. I wish I could be in rehearsal every day, but sometimes distance, and as long as you trust your colleagues, it's great because it allows me to get away from the project to come back and see it. The reason I was over there in part was because I was premiering Anthropology as well as Time Traveler. So there were some days when it was Anthropology rehearsal during the day, Time Traveler preview at night. It was just nuts. But it's, I mean, what a wonderful problem to have. Oh, it's too much
of new course.
Theater that I'm making. My goodness, what a burden.
Right. Yeah. Tell me more about Anthropology. It's one of the first AI plays. What does this mean? Tell us about this.
Well, I mean, who knows if it actually is that, but it is one of the first full productions of AI since the kind of dawn of ChatGPT. Now, AI has been around in many forms for a lot, but not in this kind of level of intensity.
Yes.
So I wrote it about a year before the ChatGPT was launched, and it was, I'm in Silicon Valley. I mean, I'm in the Bay Area, and we are constantly surrounded by this sort of technology and talk. And so it was kind of course, Lauren wrote a play about this. But it is, I am obsessed. I love it. It's a big departure from a lot of my work, which so much so that at some point I was begging my agent to kind of say, like, I should write it under a pseudonym. I don't want people to come thinking that it's Silent Sky. I want them to think of it as like, what is this edgy, wild new thing? And she was like, I think you've earned the right to write whatever you want. I was like, okay, fine. And I'm very proud of it now. And I'm glad it does not have someone else's name on it. But it is a 4-woman play about an AI programmer, much like one of my great friends Bay Area friends, who works in this exact field. Her sister is killed, and she is dealing with the obvious overwhelm of grief. And so she does a bit of a reckless thing, which is to put all of her sister's data, her phone, computer, online, you know, digital imprint into an AI and kind of recreate the sister, exactly recreate the sister in an AI form. And then that's kind of scene one. And then we go into, well, if you've created this AI, could you figure out what actually happened to her? Because there's no body. There's no sense of she kind of just vanished. It's been a year. Everyone stopped looking for her. And, you know, the small details they do have very much point to murder. And so she, but the AI says, like, that's not totally true. Like, let's figure out what actually happened. And then it becomes a thriller. So the play kind of each scene ends with a like, you know, and it's really killer roles for some of the best actors I've worked with. The amazing Miana Burning, who's probably most known for her role as on The Witcher, and she's in Downton Abbey and a bunch of movies and stuff. Absolutely an insane actor, the most incredible force of nature. Dakota Blue Richards was plays the AI sister. And what was cool is she was behind the stage the whole play doing a live broadcast of the AI, because we projected the AI on screens. And so it was a very, it felt very lived in, as opposed to we're watching, you know, a pre-recorded something. Like, she was, it felt human and visceral, which is the point of the play. So, and then it, you know, continues to turn and twist as we add the other characters until a pretty, you know, blowout ending, which I love to write those. So it was amazing, but very, very different for Time Traveler's Wife, which I'm kind of proud to have two things that were vastly different genres and approaches and styles and London at the same time.
Yeah. And so Anthropology just premiered. How long is it running?
It just closed. We had 5 weeks, 6 weeks. It was gorgeous. And yeah, I'm really, it's a tough play though. So I was kind of ready for those actors to like have a break.
Okay.
It's a very intense show. So you kind of, I don't know if you could do it for months and months and months without losing your mind.
And Time Traveler's Wife is in previews and it's about to have its opening night. How long is that slated to run?
At this point, we're until March of 2024, but hopefully we will keep it open and allow all the world to see it.
Oh, I love it. Lauren, when you were getting started, what was your idea of success? And now that you are one of the most produced playwrights in America for many years in a row, also, what does success look like to you now?
Let's see. I mean, some version of that list was my determination of success, of saying having plays done in multiple cities, having relationships with theaters who wanted more of my work, whether it's commission or we'd like to produce the next this and that. You know, I think success is a slippery thing, and it has to be based on self-satisfaction, or else you're always going to be chasing somebody else's definition of it. So I've released the part of me, and it took a while, that, you know, success is a Pulitzer, success is a MacArthur, success is a Broadway show. And that may or may not come, but that can't be the definition, because I'm going to write the things that mean the most to me. And so I've switched my definition and really take such such meaning and pride, mostly in when people reach out who don't know me and, you know, DM saying, I just did Silent Sky in my high school and I, you know, this role changed my life. Or I just got one today from somebody doing Book of Will, which is like a community theater in Canada. And like, this role is, you know, the way you talk about theater is a way I think it's worth devoting your life to and talk about. So stuff like that, that goes, okay, that's theater at work, right? Whether you get a good review or not, whether you get an extension on Broadway, whether you make a ton of money, actually has so very little to do with anything that any one of us can control. But what you can do control is the stories you tell and how important they are to you. And if they're important to you, they're going to be important to somebody else. And so getting that feedback of somebody, it sounds a little Oprah, a little cheesy, but it is that, you know, there. I see more and more, mostly women who write quotes of mine on their graduation caps, you know, they've did Silent Sky, they'll write a line from it. That's kind of a thing. It's like, wow, that is pretty cool. So I take great, I love that. But it's also just the sense of, I mean, any production is a success. Any production that a theater says, I'm going to take a risk on this, I'm going to put money and time and our heart and souls into telling this story that you wrote.
Yeah.
That's success, whether it happens once or 100 times. And is the reason why I keep writing and why I love it so much is, you know, in part because I write first from an audience perspective. I love theater. I want to see it all the time. My husband is like, oh my God, one more play. but I could see one every day. I could see two every day, you know, and you know those trips where you go to New York and like matinee and an evening. Let's do it. And so it comes from that love of an art form that doesn't always give back what you want it to. But when it does, my God, it is just a great feeling and with such appreciation for the makers of it. So centering myself in that place of going, write what you want to see, write the feeling that you wish somebody had written, write the role that you wish you had seen at this age or that age, write the truth that you see. And having that be the definition, if I manage to do that, that's the success of going, I think I did talk about love or grief or sisterhood or motherhood in a way that I really do mean. Done. Great. Success.
Oh, that's so good. When you're developing a new play, how do you know what notes to take from others in the development process and which ones to ignore?
I mean, ask who they're coming from and know who they're coming from. There are people that I will take almost every note because I love them and know them and trust that they know me. So those are your best notes. But also sometimes, like in Time Traveler's Wife, asking, is this a note that we need because of the set? There's a lot of notes that are not about dramaturgical concern, but about we need another 10 seconds for her to do a quick change backstage before she comes on and says this. So we need two more lines. We need this. Or, you know, so that stuff is sometimes there are practical notes, which, again, as long as they don't destroy something, I would say make your collaborators' lives easier. Be like, let me give the guy two more lines so she can change. I mean, I think a lot of them are, you're just going to have to trust your gut. Assume always that you know your story. If we're talking to playwrights and book writers and lyricists and stuff, you know, do you want your name on that? If you change it because of some note, is it yours? Does it feel like yours? Does it feel like it is, you want your name on it? And, you know, if it comes with we'll produce it if you do this, this, and this, and goes like, I don't want that. Then trust that you don't need that person who doesn't get it. I think a lot of young writers, as I totally understand, can get very just at the mercy of people's ideas and feel like, well, if I change it, then they'll produce it, or change it, then they publish it. And but people who ask you to change stuff that you don't agree on, that's not a collaborator you should be working with. You'll know. Sometimes in the talkbacks, audience notes are incredibly tedious and sometimes offensive. And sometimes somebody has a great point and you're like, that is a fabulous point. And sometimes it's not a direct note. I always say it's like the note behind the note. So like, I don't know why the title, I didn't like the title. And that makes me like, but then sometimes you think about it a little bit, like, why? Oh, because they don't understand, and I can maybe help them understand why that title is the perfect title. If I add this monologue or this imagery or blah, blah, thank you, random audience member that I thought I hated. I actually really appreciate, you know, so that's part of it too is, but yeah, just also it's fine to be like, oh no, I'm not going to do that. No, thank you. Thanks. You should go write your own play. Bye.
Yes. Fair. Tell us about your anthology and your new novel.
Yeah, the anthology is amazing. I have a little copy of it somewhere. It's just such an honor. Again, another reason I love London is Bloomsbury and Methuen Drama are producers, publishers of great theater. And one tradition in the UK is that they will publish in a beautiful form a new play so that audience members can leave this production of a world premiere and go and have the play that they can buy right there, which we don't do here, but we should. And so that's part of how I got connected to them when they did a specific publication of INU for that production. And they have just been like another committed collaborator for a while now. So when they asked about doing an anthology, I haven't had one before. I haven't actually had any trade publications in the U.S. So only the like trade publication, you know, the pretty ones with the photo on the front. And I've had actor editions and I love them. And I usually get to choose the color. So that makes me happy. But the fancy product publications. And so the U.K. publishers have done that and included, you know, a lot of my plays. And this was a chance to kind of collect them. And, you know, the best part of an anthology is not just like, oh, they're all published in one, but it was able to convince one of my favorite dramaturgical minds, Julie Dubiner, to collaborate and write essays on all of the plays and give context and history. And her work is extraordinary. And so it's really an honor to have her, you know, bring a kind of academic perspective to the plays, which helps, I think, would help readers, you know, just understand what I was attempting to do and how it sits in the context of other writers and on and on. So that's it. And it's got a nice, pretty pink cover.
Yes. Yes. And the novel?
Yes, the novel was, this is a brand new one. I've never written a novel before and frankly thought that I would never do it. But my team is working now to get it out and we'll sell it. And it is a combination of an archetype that I really love because it is inherently a feminist archetype, which is of a mm-hmm. witch. So mm-hmm. the premise is, the idea for it occurred to me, again, spending a lot of time in London, a lot of time going to the Globe, and a lot of time thinking about Shakespeare. And so, well, what if we set it in that era? 1609 is when it is. And they're like, what if witches were real? And mm-hmm. they went to see a play at the Globe and it happened to be Macbeth. And they saw mm-hmm. the first scene and were like, that is not what witches are like. So I love the idea of these. It's a sisterhood, a group of sisters, and they're all, you know, witches. And but it's a dangerous time, of course. Shakespeare mm-hmm. was around where King James I, who is a notorious kind of witch hunter, and the witch trials were so terrible at that time. So it felt like a really interesting way to talk about feminism, witchy fun, you know, it's romantic, it's sexy, it's dangerous. There, mm-hmm. Will Shakespeare is a minor character. It's like all the things that I want in my life. And then again, as I mentioned before, when you're in this profession, you can write the thing you want. And yes. I did. I'm so excited. So hopefully it'll be out sometime, maybe as soon as next year. We'll see.
Ooh, awesome. Can't wait. Okay, so you are like the busiest person. How do you have time to do all the things? You've got this anthology. You've got these plays premiering. You're writing other stuff. You have a novel. Like, and you're on social media all the time, first of all. And you're a mom. Do you have a social media team? And how do you have time to do all the things?
I should. I mean, the social media stuff is like just whenever it occurs to me. And, you know, I've now become a little bit good at it so I can just do it quickly. But it's mostly yeah. just a little bit of where in the world is Lauren?
Yeah.
Honestly, the reason why anyone can do anything is childcare. So
yes.
You know, my family made it a priority for both my husband and I to have childcare that we can trust. And my definition of that is I can leave. When I mm-hmm. can leave and feel like the world is not going to crumble behind me, that's yeah. in some ways, that's the definition of success. So yeah. that is where we've invested our resources in, is that, which allows me to go to London when I need to, go to anywhere when I need to, developing mm-hmm. a musical. Speaking of Macbeth, it's a Macbeth prequel about the witches called Sinister, with Jiraiya Kwame. That's at Chicago Shakes. And, you know, mm-hmm. there's all these, a lot of projects in New York. So I need to go. And mm-hmm. I love my family very much. And I just took the boys with me last time to London, which they'd never been in, this kind of place that mom always goes. And so they got to go with me and do a bunch of fun touristy stuff and see Time Traveler's Wife, which was nice.
Yes. What was their review?
My youngest really liked it. The oldest, he's a tough crowd. So he was like, yeah, so I liked it, which is about as good as you can get from him. So fabulous. I will always. Yeah. yes. yeah. And so I, you know, it's the help you have to have. I mean,
yeah.
There's no other way to do it. It's hard when they're not in school and, you know, but I do have to split my time. I am a writer that I really do like writing, not just mm-hmm. having written. And so mm-hmm. I would do it all the time. I think the reason why I wrote that novel, which was, I was in the UK, as I mentioned, a bunch, and my family wasn't able to join me. And so I was there alone and I would be able to work during the day on the plays. And then in the evenings and on the weekends, just write hours and hours and hours a day, and suddenly ended up with a novel, which is what happens when you like writing and you have yeah. time. And so the room of one's own of it, the time of one's own, is yep. no joke for me. And so it is, I'm at my best when I'm typing away.
Yes. I love that. You have a signature pink streak in your hair and you're often wearing pink as like today. When did the pink streak first come? How long has that been around?
Oh, yeah. You know, I had my second kid and I felt like a mom. And I was like, I need to be a little weirder than this. So I dyed it. And there was a couple streaks, and then it felt like a little too much. So just have the one, and I just keep – pink is the one that – the color that fades the easiest and the prettiest. So, like, purple sometimes can get a little steely and weird, and green can look a little snotty. And so I just keep going back to pink. And then once you have a signature color, I'm a very easy person to buy presents for, because anything pink, I'll be like, oh, my God, I love it. And then it's like you get so many clothes that are pink, you become a bit of a crayon, which I try to diversify. But I don't know. It's just the thing, and it makes me happy every time I look at it. So why not?
I love it.
Make you happy?
Absolutely. So this is 101 stage adaptations. Lauren Gunderson, I want to know, what are some of your favorite stage adaptations?
Ooh. Let's see. I am always partial to anything Shakespeare or Jane Austen. And so I love any version that takes the history or the stories that they've written and spins them a little bit. Mm. I've gotten in many fights about which Pride and Prejudice filmed adaptation is the best one, Keira Knightley. But I would actually want to combine Matthew McFadden as Darcy and Lizzie from the Colin Firth one. But anyway, dreams. I don't know. I'm kind of drawing a blank of all of them. I don't know. There's so many good ones. I actually thought the recent Matilda adaptation was really good, both on stage and screen into a musical. Was wonderful. Yeah.
Lovely. So you just mentioned about how you like to write, and there's people like me who like to have written. What advice can you give to people who need to embrace the process of writing so that they can have written?
I'll be a bit of a broken record, but part of it is I feel like writing is most frustrating when you don't know where you're going. Mm. It can be easy when you're like, great, I know that at the end of this chapter or scene, he's got to leave and she's got to try to stop him, but he ends up leaving. Great. Let's just take that. You can write that right now. And what a great thing. You know where you're going. You know how to write. You got to earn the thing. How are we going to write the fight when she's like, stay? And he's like, no, and whatever. Or let's say this is the scene when they kiss. Oh, what a fun scene to write. Okay. So we know that that's going to be the end of the scene. How do we get to the point where she's leaving and he stops her with the kiss, or I don't know. So to me, it's always about knowing where you're going. And the liberation of that is knowing that you have a goal in mind and you're setting it up. And so the work feels productive and pointed and supported, as opposed to just writing, trying to find a plot point or trying to find an exit. That feels like wandering, and it feels wishy-washy. And so that's the feeling that I think aimed me towards going, I don't like that feeling of not knowing. Well, maybe I can just know. And so that I think helps me love to write. And in fact, when I get anxious about a story, or that I feel like I don't have a center, I just start even the barest version of outlining on I have a pad right here next to me where I was just working on this other novel and going, okay, so the next 10 chapters, let's just say this is the chapter where she says, I hate you. The next chapter is the one where she wins a prize and he says, congratulations. And she starts to think, maybe I don't hate him. The third, next chapter is, right, like the most general thing, but it just, every little bit of clarity and pointedness can help you just find something to grasp onto. And then you get to be your best self as a writer and go, okay, I've read a lot of kissing scenes. I've seen a lot of kissing scenes. How is mine going to be different? You know, how is mine going to, is it banter? Is it smolder? What are we doing here? And that's the fun of going, now I can tap into all of my creativity and my specific voice to write this thing, the plot point, in a way that is uniquely me, which is the most fun thing ever, to feel like I am using my best self. That's when I enjoy it the most. So I think I just arranged my process in a way to limit the anxiety of not knowing where to go by just knowing where to go. And it's funny, it's not very mysterious. You just have to decide, which is the hardest thing as a writer to do, to decide. I get that. But that is what you literally have to do. So as soon as you just embrace the fear of going, I am deciding that yes, they are getting together in the end, or yes, he is killing the king at the end, or yes, this is the Titanic's going to sink. Okay. Once you just say that, then it doesn't mean, honestly, again, you're making it up. You can change it. But once you have something that you're writing towards, you can write almost anything. And that is, I think, if I have any sort of advice, it is some version of that.
Mm, I love that so much. Oof. Thank you. You've given us a masterclass in playwriting, musical writing, all the things. My final theater question for you is, if you found a magic lamp with Dionysus inside and he could grant you one theater wish, Lauren Gunderson, what would you wish for?
Oof. I would wish for the ability to write music.
Mm.
Because I am overwhelmed with admiration for all the musicians I get to work with and deeply jealous of their superpower. So I would say, hey, Dionysus, quick question. Can I have the ability to write amazing songs? Thank you. And play all the instruments that I need to make them. So
yes. Fabulous. Oh, well, you have so many things coming up next. Let's talk about all of them. First of all, Time Traveler's Wife. When and where is it playing? How do we get tickets?
Yes.
What else
Time
you have
Traveler's
going on?
Wife. Yes, that is, should be on the West End for a little while. After that, we don't know, but I'm sure there might be a Broadway, there might be a tour, we'll see. But it's, you can listen to it right now. The cast album is already out, so you can get a taste of the beautiful songs on all of the streamers and Apple Music and Spotify and everything. So just look up Time Traveler's Wife Musical. And then what else is going on? I have a bunch of projects that are kind of kicking around for development and premieres hopefully next year. One I'm really excited about is called Sinister. This is the Macbeth prequel. It focuses on the witches, but they're like young and cool. And that one, Jirai Kwame did the most, oh my God, his music, insane, incredible. So that one is a commission from Chicago Shakes. So we're working with them to do some more development and get it up on stage as soon as we can. Oof. Another musical is with Kira Stone. This is Built for This, which is a very powerful kind of, I keep describing it as like a radically efficient and simple story, which is about five young gymnasts they're contending with an abuser in the Olympic system. This is based on Larry Nassar, though we never mention his name because he does not need to be spoken of more. But it is this really empowering, a story of sisterhood and reckoning. And Kira's music is super poppy and just like powerhouse belting numbers. We're working with director Lauren Lataro, who is incredible choreographer as well as director, and the idea of like gymnastics being like full force gymnastics plus full force choreo plus full force song and story. So I'm just like obsessed. So we're aiming. We have a couple development things lined up for that. Ari Afsar had done an amazing job of taking my tiny little play, I Knew, like the little play that could, and turning it into a musical. So she's done a great job of like doing the impossible, which is a two-person musical. There are a few that exist, but not many. And this one just felt like the right story to go with what she is so incredibly good at, and bring it into the story that I love. And it's become, you know, beloved across the world, but to give a new version of it that it is a play that wants to sing. So and then a bunch of other plays. I've got a Shakespeare adjacent one that kind of takes the women of Hamlet and, you know, screws around with Shakespeare's plot. What other ones am I doing? Anthropology. I'm excited to bring it to the U.S. someplace. I don't know exactly where, or when. We're still just kind of starting those conversations, and a couple of other projects in the UK that are coming up. And, you know, I'm just all into my novel writing era now too. So I love that. Yes. There's just a lot going on and such so delightful much. Things here and there.
Oh, and where can people, keep up with all of the things you have going on?
I mean, Instagram is kind of the best, but I have a website, lauriegunderson.com as well. And I don't know, that's probably where I'm most accessible.
I love it. Awesome. Well, I'm going to have all of those links in the show notes for everybody. Lauren Gunderson, this has been the highlight of my year.
Oh, you're the best. You're so wonderful, Melissa. Thank you for all you do, for telling the stories of storytellers and for your passion for theater. It's so cool.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for listening to this episode of 101 Stage Adaptations. If you liked it, I hope you'll follow or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts, and you'll be notified every time a new episode drops. 101 Stage Adaptations is produced by me, Melissa Schmitz, with the help of Hello Podcast Media. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time.